You are listening to the Already Gone podcast, sharing stories of the missing, the murdered, the mysterious, and the lost.
It's a sign they haven't given up yet.
Our loved one is gone, and someone is looking for her, and she is loved, and we search for her every day.
Dozens came out for the Missing in Michigan Persons Day. The event allows law enforcement to update a missing persons report and collect things like DNA to help them get one step closer to bringing someone home.
Tammy, Cindy, and Siobhan.
More than 4,000 names are on this table. They all represent missing people in Michigan. More than 2,500 of them are children.
On Saturday, May 6th, I attended the Missing in Michigan event, sponsored by the Michigan State Police. I thought about attending it last year as the host of my brand new baby podcast, and I decided against it. I didn't think I was ready to be there. When I went this year, I was still having second thoughts. I didn't know what place I had at the event. Journalist, well, that doesn't quite cover it. And I didn't want to go just to look around or to hand out my card and see who might want to share their story with me. I don't have a missing loved one. I'm not in law enforcement. So I was feeling out of place. When I arrived, I spotted two women that I knew, or at least knew of. Mary Cross, who organizes the Missing in Michigan Facebook page and tirelessly guides families through the properly sharing their loved ones' information online. She's an advocate for the missing, not just the new cases, but all of them. With her was Risa Smith. Risa is an advocate for a murder victim, 5-year-old Nevaeh Buchanan, who was taken from her home and buried alive on the banks of the River Rouge, back in May of 2009. No one has ever been arrested or charged in Nevaeh's death. Yes, her case is on my list, but I'm not ready to tell her story just yet. I've long admired these two, and meeting them and thanking them for their efforts would have been enough. But it was just the start of an amazing, inspiring day. Donna Davis, the mother of Tamala Nikki Wells, she was there. And to see her face and hold her hand while we talked about Nikki and Nikki's two children, to look at the hole in her life since her granddaughter called her so early one August morning, back in 2012, to say that Nikki was missing. Ms. Davis is doing her best to stay strong and remain faithful and believe that her daughter will be returned to her someday. What came next were the stories. I listened to Kelly, the cousin of Richard Hitchcock, talk about missing him, and looking everywhere they could to find him, and the crazy places they've searched for Richie, who was last seen leaving a bar, December 22, 1990. She shared how they convinced a homeowner to let them dig under their house for Richie's remains, a hole 5 feet high and 12 feet long, or about 1.5 meters high and 4 meters long. The group laughed with her at the escapade and understood that it was necessary, that they will leave no stone unturned to bring someone home. When Tanya Zuvers, the mother of the missing skeleton boys, addressed the group, it was Kelly who stood beside her for support, as Tanya told her own harrowing story. And I'm certain there wasn't a dry eye in the house when she talked about Andrew, Alexander, and Tanner, and how she wonders where they are, if they're warm and fed. Are they getting tucked in at night? How she wishes she could be the one to do that just once more. These pieces that I'm sharing with you today, it doesn't do the event justice. There was this overwhelming mix of anxiety and optimism and determination that filled the air. The love and support shared among these people was inspiring. No one wants to join their club. No one wants to have a loved one who never returned home. But if you do join them, they're yours. I don't have much family that can help me search, lamented the mother of a missing child. The response from the room was strong. Someone even called out, "We are your family." While at the event, I also spoke with Anne Stislicki, the mother of Danielle Stislicki, who disappeared December 2nd, 2016. We talked about trying to have a normal Christmas, and we talked about what it's like to go to work at the same place your daughter worked, and every day you go there and she's not there. We talked about being there for your own children when one of them is missing. So today, I'm sharing Danielle's story. The first week of December 2016 was pleasant for winter in Michigan. There was no snow on the ground, and daytime temperatures were in the high 30s, and I seem to recall a string of clear, mostly sunny days. It was Friday, December 2nd, that 28-year-old Danielle Stislicki was last seen. She'd left her job at an insurance company in Southfield, gone in her black Jeep Renegade, and headed out towards her apartment in Farmington Hills. Before we continue, we've been to this area before. Tina Bigger, the student turned call girl turned murder victim, she lived in Farmington Hills, and her Muirwood apartment was less than a mile from Danielle's apartment. We're also about a mile away from the Farmington location where 18-year-old Deborah Rentschler's body was found in 1980. All three locations are just off Grand River Avenue, a state trunk road that runs from the city of Detroit all the way to Lansing in mid-Michigan. Danielle was looking forward to the weekend. While she was scheduled to work until after 6 p.m. on Friday, her job was slow that day and she received permission from a supervisor to leave early. Danielle had plans that Friday night, meeting a girlfriend for dinner. In fact, Danielle sent the friend a text which said, "Hey, I'm getting out early." She was going to swing by her place and get a few things before meeting up with the friend. Except, Danielle didn't show up. She didn't respond to texts, and she didn't call or text to cancel their plans. When Danielle hadn't responded by Saturday, the 3rd, her friend went to Danielle's apartment. She found Danielle's car, the black Jeep Renegade, parked right outside the door of her unit. When she rang the buzzer for Danielle's apartment, there was no answer. So she called and texted her again. Nothing. It was when she looked into Danielle's Jeep that she became concerned, because Danny's purse was sitting on the front seat. Danny was scheduled to work that Saturday, and she didn't call in, nor did she show up. Her family was notified, and the alarm was raised. Danny Stislicki was missing. Farmington Hills police responded to the missing persons call Saturday night and worked through the night into Sunday, chasing leads and trying to piece together information about Danny's last hours. The only place they knew Danielle was her workplace near 10 Mile and Telegraph. This gave them a place to start. They were joined by Southfield Police in looking for Danny. From my conversation with Assistant Chief Matt Kane of the Farmington Hills Police, not one of them wanted to call it a night and go home, but in the early hours of Sunday morning, it was decided that getting some sleep so that they could be focused and prepared for Sunday was important. By Monday morning, search warrants were issued and executed. They were looking for information on Danielle's phone, checking cameras along the route she would have taken to her home to see if they could find her car, the black Jeep Renegade, along her usual route. Police in Southfield, where her workplace was located, along with Farmington Hills Police, the Michigan State Police, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation were running down leads and tracking evidence. While Danny's purse was in her car, her cell phone, keys, and teal Eddie Bauer jacket were missing. Pictures of Danny, along with photos of her jacket, her cell phone, a Samsung Galaxy Core Prime in a rose gold case, and Danny's keychain were circulating on social media. Friends used the hashtag #FindDanny to raise awareness. If you follow me on Twitter or on Facebook, I too shared these pictures and stories hoping to boost the signal and get Danny's picture in front of someone who may have seen something, something that could help investigators. Now, when I venture into the hills or Novi to shop or dine, missing persons posters are taped up at businesses throughout the community. Even now, months later, I'm still seeing the hashtag #FindDanny online and seeing her missing persons posters in local businesses. In December, and again in January, a house in Berkeley was searched. The home belonged to a former co-worker of Danny's. And former co-worker, it's not quite right. If you believe what you read on social media, the homeowner was someone that Danny knew. A married man who worked for a security company providing services to the building her employer occupies. News reports said that evidence was removed from this home, including a mattress. Could this former co-worker, the alleged owner of the home in Berkeley, could he be someone who had a crush on Danny? Could he have connected with her that Friday afternoon? Could he have changed her plans?
The search for Danielle Stislicki seems to intensify by the day. Last night, detectives from Farmington Hills and members of the Oakland County forensic team spent hours searching for clues inside of this Berkeley home. But what's even more attention-grabbing is that investigators have searched this home not once, not twice, but several times in the last few weeks.
It's just a little alarming that somebody would be involved in something, if it's true.
By now, most of the neighborhood knows the investigation here is tied to the disappearance of Danielle Stislicki. She has not been seen since December 2nd, and police believe she is a victim of a crime. Today, the Farmington Hills police chief said detectives, evidence technicians, and crime lab personnel from several law enforcement agencies have been working tirelessly and remain committed to finding Danielle and solving this case.
News reports state that the items removed from the house in Berkeley included floorboards, a mattress, and other items. Evidence from this search was sent to the Michigan State Police Crime Lab and even to the FBI for processing. At the end of January, nearly 2 months after Danielle vanished, her parents quietly packed up the contents of her apartment. I remember reading about this when it happened, and my heart sank. This development was not a positive one. With no sign of Danielle and law enforcement keeping their cards close to the vest, the investigation seems to be stalled. But I can assure you, that is not the case. This investigation is open, active, and there are dozens of investigators still working hard to find Danny. While digging into this story, I talked with Farmington Hills Assistant Police Chief Matt Kane to find out what's new and to see what else we can do to help find Danny.
Thank you for sitting down with me today. I really appreciate it. Would you like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Sure. I am Assistant Chief Matt Kane of the Farmington Hills Police Department.
And we're talking today about Danielle Stislicki, who disappeared on December 2nd, 2016, potentially from her home in Farmington Hills. She was last seen leaving her job in MetLife in Southfield, and it's clear that her car made it back to her residence in Farmington Hills. Can you tell me if Danielle also made it to her apartment?
At this time, we do not believe she made it back to the apartment. Obviously, we know her vehicle made it there, but we have no indication or evidence to show that she went back in her apartment.
I understand that not only was her car there, but her purse, but not her keys or phone.
Correct.
Okay. And then in January, a house in Berkeley, which is 12, 15 miles from Farmington Hills, was searched, and that house possibly belongs to a former coworker of Danielle's. Can you tell me about that search or what that entailed?
Yes, we did conduct more than one search warrant at a home in Berkeley on Oxford Street. We conducted the search warrant in order to attempt to obtain evidence. I can't talk too much about the evidence we obtained, but I can confirm that we did search a house in Berkeley that where a former coworker of hers did live.
Can you tell me if this former coworker is a suspect or person of interest?
Yeah, we're not making any formal announcement of a person of interest and or a suspect, but we are following up on our leads.
Okay, and if someone has information about her disappearance, who should they contact?
The best number to contact is our patrol command desk, which is 248-871-2610. That will be answered by a sworn officer here in Farmington Hills, and they will take any information, and we urge people, anyone that has information, to contact us, and then it'll be routed to the investigators for follow-up.
And I assume that you've been in close contact with her parents and sisters about the investigation?
Yes, we have a very close working relationship. I will tell you that the Stislicki family has been great. They've been very strong. They've been just incredible. You know, there's a lot of ups and downs, and we've gone through it together where you know, sometimes they feel down and we try to bring them up and vice versa, depending upon what's going on. We've got a very close relationship with Danielle's mom, dad, sisters, where we talk quite a bit. And that's at my level, kind of the executive level. The detectives working the case talk to them even more. So they've been absolutely fabulous. You know, our heart goes out to them, and we're really doing anything and everything we can to get them through this.
Is there a reward available for information leading to an arrest or Danny's return?
Yes, there is a reward of up to $130,000 through a combination of a couple different sources for that information. And the best way to report that, again, is through our command desk, and that way we can follow up on it immediately.
And I understand you're still looking for some evidence in the case. Not only are you looking for Danny, but you're looking for her teal Eddie Bauer jacket, her phone, and her car keys?
Yes. And again, anybody with information, you know, now that the weather is nice, we're hoping people will be outside a little bit more. You know, anybody that finds any of that, we'd really appreciate it if they contacted us.
Okay, and I'm going to post pictures of all of those items, not only on our website, but on Facebook and on Twitter, so you listeners can share that information out. Is there anything else that you would like listeners to know about the case or about Danielle?
You know, we're in constant contact with the family. We work on the case daily. You know, I know that sometimes the lack of information is frustrating to the public, but we really have to be careful what we release. Our main goal here is to find Danielle. That trumps everything, and then hold the people responsible, you know, hold them accountable. So that's our biggest goals here. I know it's frustrating that we don't release a lot of information, but we really have to be careful. And that we are working every day. We're in constant contact with the family. We're making progress. And, you know, as we make progress, do that, it leads to more work. I can just assure the public that we are working very diligently. Not a day doesn't go by that we're making some progress.
Danielle's employer, MetLife, is offering a $50,000 reward. Her family, via a GoFundMe account, is offering a $30,000 reward. And the apartment complex where Danielle lived is offering a $50,000 reward for her safe return. If you have information about Danielle or know her whereabouts Friday, December 3rd, 2016, after 5 p.m., the Farmington Hills Police would like to hear from you. 248-871-2610. In the last year, since I started this podcast, I've worked with a lot of law enforcement agencies, and not many were as open and helpful as the Farmington Hills Police. A big thank you to them for talking with me about this open and very active investigation.
Danielle Stislicki was last seen wearing a turquoise jacket, leaving MetLife in Southfield Friday around 5 p.m. She was on her way to meet a friend for dinner, but never showed up. Her parents say it wouldn't be unlike her to help someone out with a ride.
We're hoping that that isn't how it turned out this particular time, that her generosity and givingness wasn't her final undoing.
What police need right now, anyone who may have seen her leave MetLife on Telegraph or driving on 10 Mile Road in her mud-covered Jeep Renegade. They're also trying to find her keys, which had a unique yellow charm, and her cell phone, a Galaxy Prime, in a pink case.
In addition to sharing information about Danny's disappearance, I wanted to revisit cases that I covered very early in the podcast. If you go back and listen to them, I want to apologize for the audio quality. There is absolutely a learning curve to podcasting, and I have learned a great deal in the months since those episodes were released. The first case I would like to revisit is the disappearance of 28-year-old Cindy Moore. Moore was the mother of a 2-year-old boy, Nicholas, with her soon-to-be former husband, Billy Moore. The two of them shared a home near 14 Mile and Mound in Warren. On Thursday, May 23rd, Cindy left her job at the Postal Annex in Troy, Michigan. She headed south to 14 Mile Road, where she was spotted by a coworker heading eastbound on 14 Mile in her car, a gray Ford Tempo. Cindy was headed to pick up her son. On Friday, Billy Moore reported that Cindy never showed up to retrieve Nicholas. On that rainy Memorial Day weekend, friends and family combed the area looking for Cindy. There was no sign of her. Her bank accounts were untouched. Her bedroom, as she'd moved back home with her mother, was unchanged. It didn't appear that she'd packed a bag for a trip or to get away. If her family and friends held out hope that Cindy had impulsively taken off for the holiday weekend and would be back on Tuesday, they were disappointed. There was no sign of Cindy. While she was under a lot of stress between work, being a single parent, and her divorce, she was handling things well. Cindy had recently put a deposit down on a home to share with her young son. The divorce was progressing, and Cindy was moving on with life. It was a week after she disappeared that the only sign of Cindy would be discovered. Cindy's car was found in the parking lot of the Abbey Theater across from Oakland Mall. According to law enforcement, her car was not a crime scene. There was no sign of a struggle. It was like the 5'5", green-eyed brunette had vanished. Cindy's estranged husband was a person of interest in her disappearance. Police searched his home, and at one point they dug up his backyard looking for evidence of foul play. No crime scene and no evidence of Cindy was ever found. The house she'd planned to buy became someone else's home. Her son Nicholas grew up without a mother, and today he's years older than Cindy ever was. The Oakland County Sheriff continues to investigate her disappearance, and her family and coworkers are also hoping for resolution. In the last year, I've heard from several people who knew Cindy and are hoping that the sweet, quiet woman that they knew, the dedicated mother, good friend, and coworker will be brought home. Cindy's parents are both alive and still hopeful for news. If you have information about the disappearance of Cindy Moore, please contact the Oakland County Sheriff at 248-625-8531. Another case from the early days of the podcast is the disappearance of Carol Kresge Dermont. This segment contains adult language, and it might be time for you to get your headphones. Carol grew up in Waterford, Michigan, the granddaughter of S.S. Kresge. Kresge was the enterprising and hardworking man who gave Americans a new way to shop. Before there was Walmart, Target, or Kmart, there was Kresge. Through his hard work and ingenuity, Kresge was worth more than $300 million by the age of 60. While Carol grew up comfortably, the Kresges were not extravagant people. It was on a trip to Chicago that 20-year-old Carol met the man that she would marry, Donald Dermont. Dermont was 2 decades her senior, but he was smart, wealthy, and an old-style gentleman. Nothing like men her own age. Dermont owned several businesses in the Detroit area, and he was a licensed pilot who owned his own plane. He also had a wife and children, but he soon divorced and married Carol. The two bought a home and had 3 children of their own. As the years passed, their marriage became tense, strained. While Donald was a health nut, he didn't drink or smoke, and he exercised religiously. He was nearing 60, and his pretty blonde wife was still in her 30s. Donald expected her home, with dinner on the table, waiting on his return from work, which was usually quite late in the evening. Carol wanted more from her marriage and from her life. In 1983, they'd been married 13 years, and the marriage was not a happy one. Since sharing Carol's story, I've been contacted by some of her friends and neighbors from that time, and they tell me that Carol was miserable and living in terror. Despite coming from a wealthy family, Carol had no money and could not leave him and take their children with her. The irony of coming from a family with great wealth, only to find herself financially strapped. I would like to think that in 2017, a woman in Carol's situation would be given a restraining order, barring her soon-to-be ex-husband from entering the home. But in 1983, there wasn't such a thing. After months of physical abuse, tapped phones, threats, Carol Dermont was gone. All that remained of her was a bit of blood spatter on the sofa in the den that she was using as a bedroom. When police attempted to search Donald's car and the Dermont home for evidence as to Carol's whereabouts, they were blocked by his lawyer at every turn. Dermont did nothing to help Troy police uncover what had become of his wife. Law enforcement did learn that at one of his metallurgy plants, there was an incinerator that could be used to dispose of a body. They also learned that the day Carol was reported missing, Donald Dermont took a trip in his private plane. He was gone for a couple of hours, and his flight took him out over Lake Huron. As soon as he could, Dermont put their home up for sale and moved the kids to a new city just a few miles away, out from under the watchful eye of the Troy police. Dermont was never charged with Carol's murder, but in 1986, when he was on his deathbed in the end stages of a painful, fast-moving cancer, the Troy police visited him at Harper Hospital in Detroit. They hoped the 59-year-old father of 6 would speak to them about the disappearance of his wife. When the detective asked him what became of Carol, Donald Dermont replied, "Go fuck yourself." Carol Kresge Dermont was last seen alive in Farmington Hills, Michigan at 11:30 p.m. on October 26, 1983. At the time of her disappearance, she was wearing tan slacks, a maroon blouse, and a navy blue jacket. She has not been seen since. The blonde, blue-eyed, 36-year-old mother of 3 is gone. There are so many cases that I've covered that I wish I had updates on, some news to share, even if it's that the person was found as an angel. Nikki Wells and Deanie Peters and Dawn Silvernail, Kim Larrow, James Cooper. I do have a positive update about Eric Franks. 40-year-old Eric Franks came to the Saginaw, Michigan area in 2010 after learning that he'd fathered a child with his girlfriend years earlier. Eric was adopted into a wonderful, loving family as an infant, and he was thrilled at the prospect of having someone related to him by blood. His joyful reunion with his dark-haired teenage daughter was short-lived. Kendra Firmingham, the girl's mother and her husband, who had raised the girl as his own, were not happy that Eric was sticking around. Within months of his arrival in the Saginaw area, the relationship between Eric and the Firminghams fell apart. Until March 2011, when Eric was gone. Kendra helpfully showed up at the room he'd been renting and cleaned out his things, telling the landlord that Eric had left for California. In late 2011, the Firminghams left Michigan and moved to Florida. Kendra Firmingham passed away in August of 2016. Eric and his car, a dark bronze Chevy Malibu, were never recovered. Eric's cell phone was used after his disappearance. The news reported that his phone was used to call a dental office in the Saginaw area. Kendra Firmingham said that Eric left for California, but according to cell records, his phone didn't go with him. Eric's mother and sister are still looking for him, and they learned in late 2016 Eric's case will be featured on the Investigation Discovery show Disappeared. You can watch that later in May. I'm looking forward to seeing it. This concludes a rather unusual episode of Already Gone. It is my fervent hope that the next time I do a show revisiting previous episodes, there will be resolution to one or more cases. On Saturday, May 13th, I am hosting my first Michigan meetup. We're gathering at the Old Nation Brewery, 1500 Grand River Avenue in Williamston, at 1 p.m. Please drop me an email or send me a note on Facebook if you plan to attend. June 9th through the 11th, I will be at CrimeCon in Indianapolis. There are day passes available for the event. You can use the code ALREADYGONE20 at checkout to save money. That's ALREADYGONE20, and you get 20% off a day pass. How cool is that? I hope to see you there. If you would like to talk about the cases shared here, please join us on Facebook, the Already Gone Podcast Discussion Group. Request to join, and myself or Lori, our lovely moderator, will add you. You can also find me on Twitter at AlreadyGonePod. My name is Nina Instead. I'm the creator, writer, and voice behind the Already Gone podcast. As always, I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.